Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 420, The Destabilization of California, part two, being recorded on August 11th of 2003. What we have been reading from is a paper by Catherine Eureka. It's called the Eureka Report, News Intelligence Analysis. This paper is titled Fraud Traced to the White House, subtitled How California's Energy Scam Was Inextricably Linked to a War for Oil Scheme. It's authored by Catherine, K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, Eureka, capital Y-U-R-I-C-A, and I may be mispronouncing her name. It is available on the Internet. What we're going to get back to is the Baker Energy Task Force, its recommendations to the Cheney Energy Task Force, and the references to California's energy crisis, which was deliberately manufactured, and the legislation was passed under the Republican administration of former Governor Pete Wilson, now the campaign manager for Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's making a bid to replace Gray Davis, largely over voter dissatisfaction about the state's economic condition, greatly exacerbated by the deliberate energy destabilization by corporations like Enron and Dynegy that are closely associated with this administration. Returning to the Catherine Eureka paper, by the way, before I get into the paper itself, let me remind you that sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only on a longer URL linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. There will be a detailed annotated description of the For the Record program 420 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. I'm getting caught up, but I'm about four programs or so behind. Now, turning once again to the Catherine Eureka paper, Fraud Traced to the White House, How California's Energy Scam Was Inextricably Linked to a War for Oil Scheme, we're going to be focusing mostly on the domestic economic connections here and not so much on the foreign policy recommendations. Obviously, this is an oil-slash-energy administration, and I don't think that one needs to belabor the aspects that that has, the implications that has had for American foreign policy. But what is not generally well-known, aside from the very deliberate role of Bush-linked corporations in destabilizing California, a Democratic bastion in recent years, but the California, quote, energy crisis, unquote, formed a key element in the policy recommendations that are driving this particular administration. As we'll see in the detailed analysis presented here by Catherine Eureka, the usage of the California, quote, energy crisis, unquote, is deliberately spurious here. The wording of the report itself indicates that there's a contradiction, I should say, that indicates that what happened in California would not happen nationwide, and yet it is the fear of nationwide California-style energy crises that form a significant element of this particular report. Returning to the Catherine Eureka paper, we read, the Baker Energy Task Force produced a report titled Strategic Energy Policy Challenges for the 21st Century, dated April of 2001. There is no mistaking the fact that reasonable, detailed, and important expert advice is meted out to the new president. However, this amazing 107-page report strikes a drumbeat for action that grabs the reader as it propels a picture of naked energies, However, this amazing 107-page report strikes a drumbeat for action that grabs the reader as it propels a picture of a naked, energy-scarce nation subject to energy shortages and price fluctuations across its pages. Contrasting the state of what is against what should be, and mercifully making powerful recommendations that will, quote, save our economy, unquote, it offers warnings such as a sharp rise in, quote, oil prices preceded every American recession since the late 1940s, unquote. The California energy crisis is raised again and again, along with a prophecy that America can expect, quote, more California-like incidents, unquote, in the future. There's even a connection made between the California crisis in the Middle East, which, according to the report, quote, will remain the world's baseload supplier and least expensive source of oil for the foreseeable future, unquote. With that prophetic utterance, the stage is now set for a new actor, a new villain, and a new energy policy. According to the Baker Report, Saddam Hussein became a swing oil producer by turning Iraq's oil taps on and off, unquote, whenever he felt that it was in his interest to do so. During these periods, Saudi Arabia stepped up to the plate and provided replacement oil supplies to the market to keep California-type disruptions, unquote, and scarcity from occurring in America. Hussein, the report says, used his own, quote, export program to manipulate oil markets, unquote. That, I think, will give you an idea of how the Iraqi situation fits into the recommendations here. The actual Iraqi situation, I think, is a more complex foreign policy engagement than merely energy policy, but certainly with this oil-slash-energy administration, it's not a factor that can be overlooked. Skipping down in the report, we read, on May 16, 2001, Dick Cheney officially handed the National Energy Policy National Report to George W. Bush. Ostensibly, the cabinet members that formed the National Energy Policy Development Group, or NEPDG, were its authors. But a careful study and comparison of the National Report with the Baker Report reveals the Baker Report provided the skeleton framework upon which the National Energy Policy was hung. However, the skeleton was broken up into unrelated parts, the skull in the middle, the thigh bone on top. When it was all unraveled, almost every major policy action in the Baker Report was incorporated into the National Report. The tedious process of comparing the two reports with each other occasionally revealed a subtlety. For example, the Baker Report says, the U.S. must have a strategic energy policy based on energy security, unquote. The National Report subtly changes this to, the NEPD group recommends that the President make energy security a priority of our trade and foreign policy, unquote. This foreign policy change led to the discovery that an important topic is missing from the National Report. Although every other oil-producing country was discussed in the National Energy Text, two countries were glaringly omitted from even a mention, Iraq and Iran. There's an explanation for the omissions. First, in reading the Baker Report, one is struck by the strategic military information provided, which would be odd and inappropriate in a report on energy. Secondly, the Baker Report is divided into two sections. The first part focuses on strategic steps the new administration should take immediately. The second part focuses on long-range energy policy. Taking care of Iraq, unquote, is listed as an immediate step in the Baker Report. The National Report, however, focuses solely on long-range policy. One of the most striking facts about the National Report is that it makes 110 references to California's energy crisis, which was 99 more than the Baker Report makes. Clearly, someone in the White House needed an impressive energy crisis to tout. How unfortunate that the crisis cited was fraudulently induced. Like the Baker Report, the National Report states, quote, the California experience demonstrates the crippling effect that electricity shortages and blackouts can have on a state or region, unquote. Warnings abound. Again, quoting, America in the year 2001 faces the most serious energy shortage since the oil embargoes of the 1970s, unquote. The 110 repetitions of the word California, linked with words like energy crisis and energy shortages and price spikes, unquote, could turn the National Energy Report into an ad man's prized primer. Notwithstanding its importance as an example of what could happen to other states, the author of a passage at pages 5 through 12 of the National Report suddenly yields to an impulse to relate what really happened in California. In doing so, he completely contradicts at least 105 references to California throughout the report. The significance of this contradictory entry into the National Energy Policy must not be underestimated. And again, the energy crisis, unquote, in California was deliberately manufactured by corporations that are inextricably linked with this administration, and that is the reason California is now having its total recall, so to speak. Resuming with Catherine Eureka's paper, in the process of reversing the carefully construed California experience, unquote, the author's grasp exceeds his knowledge in that his understanding of the events in California go beyond what he should have reasonably known at the time of its writing. For he wrote, quote, "The risk that the California experience will repeat itself is low, since other states have not molded their retail competition plans on California's plan," unquote. This is an astounding statement. If the California crisis was caused by a supply shortage, as the author claims a line above this sentence, surely other states could suffer similar shortages. But no, the author is actually making an admission here. He is admitting that the energy crisis in California can't be replicated in other states because certain market means do not exist in the other states. How could the author know this? The writer of that sentence would have to be someone intimately involved in the California system, know the real cause of the state's crisis, and be familiar with all the other state rules and market infrastructures. And note again that this is a double-level scam. It's at statewide, actually it's many levels, statewide political, it is nationwide political, it is international and strategic, and it is the basis for California's current political instability. Continuing with this report, but our knowledgeable author is not done. In trying to amplify what he just revealed, he tried to hide the true actors in the next sentence by misdirecting the reader away from the culprits to blame the state. This is a formula for incoherence. Nonetheless, the writer's sentence found its way into the National Energy Report, where it spoke for the Bush administration. Quote, California's failure to reform flawed regulatory rules affecting the market drove up wholesale prices, unquote. If this sentence is read literally, it asks the reader to believe that a state's experience of failure to amend its rules, along with the flawed rules themselves, somehow had an independent power to, quote, drive up wholesale prices, unquote, without an intervening acting agent. The only sensible reading left to us is that the flawed rules allowed power brokers to manipulate the system, and again, note the close, inextricable association of those power brokers with this administration, and not only the resulting effect on California, but also the recommendations that have also gone into the foreign policy hopper as well. Returning to Catherine Eureka's paper, but how could our author and his administration editors know this to be true without being in collusion with the wrongdoers? If they were not in collusion, they would have reported the crime. But if they remained silent, when they had a duty to report or stop the commission of a crime, they became accessories. Continuing his unexpected analysis, the author tells us, quote, actions such as forcing utilities to purchase all their power through volatile spot markets, imposing a single price auction system, and barring bilateral contracts all contributed to the problems that California now faces, unquote. This is nothing more than the author, and through him the White House, attempting to throw responsibility for any wrongdoing by energy companies in California squarely at the feet of the state. Many people were blaming the state at the time, including the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The Hoover Institution jumped into the fray and released a book by James L. Sweeney, The California Electricity Crisis, which promotes and assigns blame like this, quote, after political leaders mismanaged the electricity crisis, California now faces an electricity blight while it struggles to recover from its self-imposed wounds, unquote. Not until the Sacramento Bee broke its story, How Californians Got Burned, on May 6, 2001, 10 days before the national report was released, did the public receive the first concrete signs that the crisis may have been caused by manipulation. There was finger-pointing in the media at the time, and accusations, but there was simply no proof. But after criminal convictions for federal wire fraud came thundering down, everything changed. Following a 2-year staff investigation on March 26, 2003, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, released findings that impacted this article in the above incriminating statements section. FERC's latest investigation was to determine whether Enron or any other sellers manipulated the electricity and natural gas markets in California. In its report, Price Manipulation in Western Markets, Findings at a Glance, the FERC made the following finding, quote, "Staff concludes that supply-demand imbalance, flawed market design, and inconsistent rules made possible significant market manipulations as delineated in the final investigation report. Without underlying market dysfunction, attempts to manipulate the market would not be successful," unquote. And Catherine Eureka goes on to comment, "Amazingly, the finding eerily echoes our unknown author's statements published in the National Energy Policy document, the National Report, at pages 5 through 12. The questions I raised above are even more significant now. How could the author and the editors have inserted an accurate assessment of the causes of the California energy fraud in May of 2001 without having inside knowledge and or without being part of the scam when it took the FERC 2 years of investigation to release virtually the same findings as those published in the National Energy Report?" This last sentence again. The questions I raised above are even more significant now. How could the author and editors have inserted an accurate assessment of the causes of the California energy fraud in May of 2001 without having inside knowledge and or without being part of the scam when it took the FERC 2 years of investigation to release virtually the same findings as those published in the National Energy Report? In a letter to the vice, in a letter to the vice president dated January 25, 2002, Representative Henry Waxman outlined the information he gathered on how the national energy policy was written. Passages not included in the draft of the national report appear to have been added to the plan during the final revisions made under the direction of the White House. The White House energy plan was first drafted, Waxman says, by a, quote, "work group composed of staff from various agencies led by the executive director, Andrew Lundquist," unquote, of Dick Cheney's staff. Each chapter, according to Waxman, quote, "was drafted by one of the participating agencies," unquote, and those copies, quote, "were then circulated among all of the work group members," unquote. The work group then met to discuss each agency's comments before submitting the drafts to the White House. Waxman wrote, "Any further changes in the plan were made under the direction of the White House. No subsequent versions of the White House energy plan were circulated to the interagency work group," unquote. Assuming this description of the process applied to the chapters of the national report, it appears the White House had the final word and made the final insertions and changes to the report. In trying to answer the question, "who done it?" unquote, our Sherlock Holmes people will have to look at the top levels of the White House and the Bush administration and ask, quote, "who had sufficient knowledge of electricity markets in California and other states to have written the incriminating statements?" Speaking of Andrew Lundquist, skipping down, he was formerly the chief of staff for the Senate Energy Committee, where he served brilliantly. Bush appointed him to be executive director of the NEPD group chaired by Dick Cheney. However, he may never have seen the final changes. Beyond Cheney and Lundquist, perhaps I. Lewis Libby, Cheney's chief of staff, or perhaps Pat Wood, chairman of FERC, who may fit the profile, one runs out of names. However, another player does come to mind. He was a lone outsider who insinuated himself into a position of power in Bush's White House. He is one man who, by far, is the most knowledgeable and capable power market man in the country, and he also happened to know how the marketing system in California could be rigged. His name is Kenneth Lay, the former chairman of Enron. Indeed, Representative Henry Waxman's minority report on Enron found more instances of Ken Lay's input transferred into recommendations to the president on pages 5 through 11 and 5 through 12 than any other portion of the national report. However, the recommendations don't show the style and form of a contributing writer. So the question is, are there any correlations between relevant passages in the text with other documents written by Ken Lay? In a comparison of the two-page memo we know that Lay submitted to Cheney, the passages attributed to the unknown author reveal similarities of vocabulary, including the identical use of words, a similar style of writing, and a correspondence of ideas that is expressed. It appears that Ken Lay may have written more of the national report than was previously suspected. So what about Dick Cheney as a suspect? Although Mary Matlin, who was then serving as an advisor to the vice president, told a San Francisco Chronicle reporter that Cheney's energy plan included input from many sources, quote, "Just because some of the things are included in the plan doesn't mean they were from the talks between Cheney and Lay," unquote. However, Mary Matlin may not have known what we know now. She apparently did not know that Ken Lay wrote his memo down on paper and submitted it to the vice president. In fact, there may have been more than one memo submitted by Lay to Cheney, which might explain why the vice president went to such extremes to keep Congress from viewing those documents. It's shocking to realize that at the time the author's incriminating admissions were being submitted to Dick Cheney, then read, edited, and approved for publication by the White House, the fraudulent acts they referenced were being executed. This fact may have serious criminal justice implications for the White House. For in the spring of 2001, California was reeling from rolling blackouts and brownouts, and the price of electricity was breaking through the sky like a contrail from a speeding jet. It may be time to paraphrase Senator Howard Baker's famous questions during the Watergate hearings, quote, "What did the president and vice president know, and when did they know it?" At the very least, Congress and the people of this country need to know who wrote the incriminating passages and who read them. And again, this report goes on for quite a few pages. The title, again, "Fraud Traced to the White House, How California's Energy Scam Was Inextricably Linked to a War for Oil Scheme." It's by Catherine Eureka. It's being presented in this program as part of the context to the, obviously, the political destabilization of California, because the corporations that engaged in the deliberate market manipulation, which in turn has led to a potential changing of players on the California political scene, and it's no secret that the Republicans would like to have California under their control, corporations that have basically manipulated this situation are inextricably linked with the administration. And so obviously the destabilization of California is something that is more or less a matter of public record. And I want to note, before we conclude the broadcast, again, the opening couple of paragraphs here are very interesting indeed. This is a repetition from the first side. "This story begins with the California energy crisis, which started in 2000 and continued through the early months of 2001, when electricity prices spiked to their highest levels. Prices went from $12 per megawatt hour in 1998 to $200 in December of 2000 to $250 in January of 2001, and at times a megawatt cost $1,000. One event occurred earlier. On July 13, 1998, employees of one of the two power marketing centers in California watched incredulously as the wholesale price of $1 a megawatt hour spiked to $9,999, stayed at that price for 4 hours, then dropped to a penny. Someone was testing the system to find the limits of market exploitation. This incident was the earliest indication that the people and the state could become victims of fraud. The Sacramento Bee broke the story 3 years later on May 6, 2001. Today, Californians are still paying the costs of the debacle, while according to state officials, the power companies who manipulated the energy markets reaped more than $7.5 billion in unfair profits. During those early months of the Bush administration, and even during the prior transition period, Dick Cheney was deeply involved in gathering information for a national energy policy. The intelligence he gathered would provide justification for a war against Iraq, but would also place the White House footprints all over a fraud scam, and also set the stage for the political destabilization of California. This is something that should not be altogether surprising to people familiar with the history of the Bush family and its relationship to the petroleum industry. We're going to review a short section that we discussed in For the Record 214. This is from The Secret War Against the Jews, How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, and published in hard and soft cover by St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. And this basically, skipping down, this is talking about a period of time when Jimmy Carter had been elected president and when the elder George Bush was director of the CIA. The sources we interviewed for this chapter say that the oil industry had a well-thought-out scheme to deceive the president and control U.S. policy in the Middle East. The first part involved intelligence falsification on a grand scale. This time, our sources insist, the President of the United States was to have his, quote, pants scared right off him, unquote. The CIA was used to produce phony oil data that showed that the world's two greatest oil producers, the Soviet Union and Saudi Arabia, were running out of oil. The Soviets would be forced to fight the United States for control of Middle Eastern oil. Carter was led to believe that war was coming to the region and that the United States had to arm the Arabs to defend Western oil. In this chapter, we examine the following allegations from our sources in the intelligence community. At the end of the Ford administration, the CIA concocted a phony estimate that the Soviets would run out of oil by the mid-1980s. When that failed to sway President Carter sufficiently, the CIA concocted another phony estimate that the Saudis were running out of oil as well. As a result of these false intelligence reports, the President of the United States was deceived into believing that a Soviet invasion of the Middle East was likely, if not imminent, and that the Arabs had to be armed to defend themselves. Behind the President's back, the U.S. intelligence community agreed to hand over to the Egyptians virtually all of Israel's military secrets as an inducement to sign the Camp David peace accords, and subsequently entered into the same arrangement with Saudi Arabia. Skipping down, speaking of the oil companies, Carter's first move after the election didn't please them. He nominated former CIA head and Defense Secretary James Schlesinger as his Secretary of Energy. Worse still, Schlesinger was now a convert to environmentalism, unquote. The oil companies had noted that during his campaign, the incoming president had, quote, promised a national energy policy within 90 days of Inauguration Day. The oil men also noted that Carter, quote, was dedicated to making good on his word, unquote. For most of 1977, new energy and oil policies were practically all that was on the agenda. The energy crisis virtually became a moral crusade. Now, what I would note is that the oil shortage itself was deliberately manufactured, as well as these phony reports saying that the Soviet Union and the Saudis were running out of oil. We talked about this at considerable length in For the Record 214, and that basically is available online from WFMU. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 420, The Destabilization of California, Part 2. This is being recorded on August 11th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.